Commons Conversations is a series of interviews in which campaigners share their experiences and insights into activism, learning in movements, and radical history. Produced by the Commons Social Change Library, episodes in the fourth series cover multicultural and First Nations voices from the climate movement, regional and rural organising, artivism, fierce vulnerability and radical resilience, the fight against corporate disinformation, campaigns countering the far right, and more. The 2025 to 2026 series can be heard on Saturday afternoons between 1 and 2pm in December and January on 3CR, or found as a podcast at 3cr.org.au/actingup or via commonslibrary.org.
Hi, you're listening to Commons Conversations. I'm Sophie Hartley, researcher at the Commons Social Change Library, and I'm joined today by Dr. Kathy Rogers, senior researcher at Social Change Lab. Today we're going to be having a chat based on two pieces of research that we've each been involved in. So first, Kathy will be asking me some questions about an article from the Commons Library, which was on the tactics fossil fuel companies are using to obstruct climate action. And then I'll be talking to Kathy about a report Social Change Lab released recently about strategies and tactics to curb the fossil fuel industry, which you can find on Social Change Lab's website. So first, we're going to find out what the fossil fuel companies are doing and then how we can fight back. First of all, just to introduce Kathy, Dr. Kathy Rogers is a senior researcher at Social Change Lab, a think tank based in London that studies the impact of social movements. Before joining Social Change Lab, Kathy completed her psychology PhD at Birkbeck University of London. And before that, she produced science TV shows for many years. She loves trying to understand things which are complex and hard to measure, with her overarching goal being to try to make the world a better, more just, more equitable, and more joyful place. Thank you so much for joining me, Kathy.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. It's a really excellent pairing, I think. It's like the cat and mouse game we're going to be discussing. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I love being able to talk about what the problems are, but then really importantly, provide some solutions and how we can fight back. So like I said, we'll start with our article on tactics fossil fuel companies are using to obstruct climate action first. So I'll hand it over to you, Kathy, to start the questions rolling.
Yeah, well, thank you for the report, first of all, because I think that it's really good to have things outlined in detail, like approaches that sometimes you can wonder whether you're imagining that these things are happening. And I think to have the tactics outlined of actually the sort of very strategic way that fossil fuel corporations have gone about all sorts of campaigns of disinformation and so on is really interesting. So I just wanted to say thank you for the report. One thing that you talk about a bit is SLAP lawsuits. And I just wanted to dig into that a bit more to ask if you could explain a bit more about what they are and why they're so damaging.
So SLAP suits are one of these ways that fossil fuel companies are really attempting to intimidate their opponents. So SLAP suits, that literally stands for strategic lawsuits against public participation. They've been around for quite a long time, really. I think the term was first used, I believe, back in the 90s. But we've really been seeing them used increasingly by these fossil fuel companies over the last kind of few years. And essentially, the way it works is these powerful fossil fuel companies will use their quite infinite resources to file lawsuits against advocacy groups and organizations. And it's a way of really trying to deplete these groups' resources. And it's really a tactic of intimidation because it makes advocacy really costly for these groups. So there's this really big power imbalance when these companies come after these groups. And so we've seen it happen, for example, in the Dakota Access Pipeline protests, where companies were suing climate protesters based on kind of lost revenue, where climate protesters haven't been able to stall projects. But then fossil fuel companies, I think they're also getting quite creative with the ways that they're using this slap suit kind of technique. So here in Australia, for example, there's been this recent case where Santos has been using the courts quite creatively to intimidate climate activists and a really broad range of climate activists. So there was recently a case where TV Islanders, they took Santos to court over their kind of giant Barossa gas project. Santos did eventually win that court case. But then what they did was they tried to claim court costs from basically a whole bunch of third-party advocacy groups. So these were groups that weren't even originally part of the court case. So these companies are finding these new ways to basically use the courts to intimidate an even larger kind of group of advocates, advocates that might not even be involved in the original cases. Yeah, we're finding that can have this really massive chilling effect, right? Because it becomes really, really costly for organizations, even when they're just trying to support climate impacted communities. And I guess one final thing that I'll just quickly say about these slap suits, at least here in Australia, we don't have great protections against slap suits. So I know that there are organizations here like the Australian Democracy Network, like the Human Rights Law Centre, and they've been calling on the government to pass some legislation that might help to create some protections against slap suits. And I think it's really important that we kind of support these efforts and that we really try to protect our rights to stand up against the powerful organizations when they do harm and then the harm that they're doing.
Obviously is very effective because it works not only with the immediate case, but also is a very major red flag to other people who are planning to take any kind of action that this could be coming their way. So it's very insidious. It
Absolutely.
kind of almost reminds me of the use of NDAs in the kind of civic space, especially against like women wanting to speak out against harassment and things, that you put an NDA and then suddenly you silence people and you know, there's this threat of huge litigation if you break your NDAs. Okay, so my next question is really about the time that we're living in now and the scope that there is for bad actors, including fossil fuel companies, to spread misinformation when it's so easy for those messages to be amplified through social media. How are regular people who might not be as au fait as you are with the ins and outs of particular arguments, how are they to know what information to trust?
Yeah, I think this is such a great question. And I guess, first of all, I think this is just one of those examples of why it's so important to be teaching skills like digital literacy and media literacy from a really early age. I think those are the kinds of skills that we need more and more and more. But I guess, in terms of things that people can do, ordinary people can do, activists can do, really conveniently, actually, some of my colleagues at the Commons Library just did this really fantastic project on countering disinformation. So we have a whole host of really, really accessible resources on our website about how to counter disinformation, about what you should be looking out for under the Countering Disinformation collection. But I guess just some really basic things. If you're first of all trying to spot misinformation or disinformation, I think asking just some really simple questions can be a great place to start. So who's sharing it? Is it a reliable source? Really questioning why they're sharing it. What connection do they have to the issue? Do they have a particular agenda? What impact are they trying to have? Just asking some of those basic questions before you kind of consume a particular message is really helpful to help you to kind of pause and think. And then I guess the flip side of that is if you're trying to counter misinformation that you've seen and you know that this is misinformation, there's all sorts of techniques I think that you can use. So for example, there's the kind of truth sandwich technique, which is basically where you state the truth, then you address the misinformation, and then you state the truth again. So you're really kind of sandwiching in the misinformation with the truth. So you're not focusing too much on that kind of opposition narrative. And then beyond that, I think more generally, really just trying to connect with people on values rather than immediately jumping to facts and data. And I think, you know, connecting with people on values can really help to break down some of those barriers that misinformation and disinformation can thrive on. Misinformation and disinformation, I think it often kind of thrives on those us versus them dynamics, right? But I think the good news is that you know, activists are often really great at and have had a lot of practice with values-based communication. And so sticking to that and to that kind of values-based communication, I think is a really effective way of pushing back against that increased misinformation and disinformation that we're seeing spreading through our communities for sure.
I think that it's such a great piece of advice because I think people are often in a dilemma about how to talk about things that are not true because sometimes by repeating them, you can reinforce them inadvertently. So I think the practical things like the truth sandwich is great. And actually, like, don't start with picking apart that, start with what are the values that we share. Oh, it feels like, it's really helpful, those kinds of advice. And I couldn't agree with you more about general digital literacy. I think it's hard enough from a sort of older generation, and at least we know something else. Whereas I think for younger generations who exist in the digital world of that's how they consume their news, to understand how to evaluate a source and how to evaluate the veracity of a piece of information is so crucial for all sorts of things, maintaining democracy, very basic things. So, in the report, you use this term astroturfing, which I have to admit, I hadn't heard that term before. So, I wondered if you could explain a bit more about what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's not surprising that you haven't heard of this term, because I think astroturfing is one of these really sneaky kind of tactics that fossil fuel companies and their allies are using. And it's basically where a fossil fuel company or their allies might want to make it seem like there's this really big grassroots kind of community support for a particular issue that favors them. So, this big grassroots support for coal or for gas or against renewable projects. And they want to make it seem like there's this community support, even when that's not the case. So, as you know, AstroTurf is fake lawn, AstroTurfing is basically a fake grassroots. So, I think the example of this that we use in the article is a case from a few years ago where Glencore ran this kind of coordinated Project Caesar pro-coal campaign. And basically, they had a whole host of Facebook groups and pages that were set up to try and spread kind of pro-coal and anti-renewable messages. And it was really meant to give this appearance that there was this big kind of grassroots movement, lots of community groups that were really, really pro-coal. But then I think a bunch of Guardian journalists dug into these groups and looked into them, and they realized that most of these groups were actually administered by people connected to the industry. So these weren't legitimate community groups at all. These were just kind of front groups that were created by industry insiders to give the appearance of community support for coal. And I think more recently, GetUp, the organization in Australia, has seen similar things happening with pro-nuclear groups as well. So we see this happening quite a lot. And it's a very, very sneaky tactic that the companies are using that can make people feel like support for climate action is much lower than it actually is, and support for things like coal and gas is much higher than it actually is.
The levels of cynicism are just off the charts, aren't they? It's like it makes greenwashing look relatively benign. It's because I suppose what it effectively does as well is give a platform to the sort of outliers who maybe do want a new coal plant or whatever, and because they got something to adhere to. So, I mean, it's hard to be shocked when you know the tactics that are deployed, but sometimes you come across a new one that you're just like, oh my God, that's even next level. So, coming back to sort of like the particular time we live in, obviously the Trump campaign, Drill Baby Drill, gave everyone a sense of what was going to be coming down the line in the US. And I mean, thankfully, he's no longer in power. But when Bolsonaro was running the ship in Brazil, there were all sorts of sort of like backsteps in terms of climate progress. And I wondered whether there are tangible examples that you know of how fossil fuel companies behave even worse when they know that they have governments on their sides.
Yeah, it's absolutely true that the fossil fuel industry can be really good at adapting their tactics and ramping up their tactics to kind of work with the political climate of the day, right? And so I know, organizations like Influence Map have done some really great work looking at how fossil fuel companies changed their tactics kind of before and after Trump took office, both times he took office. So doing things like trying to roll back the previous administration's climate policies and really ramping up those kinds of efforts. And then I was also recently reading some really interesting research into climate obstruction in Brazil, like you said, under Bolsonaro, that talked about how climate misinformation and disinformation really, really increased significantly in Brazil over that time, and that this was practiced by government, by business, by think tanks, and even by religious groups. It was really spreading quite far throughout the society. And so I think, you absolutely see these fossil fuel companies kind of taking advantage of these politically opportune moments. But I guess also, no matter where we are in the world, when fossil fuel industry has kind of too great access to and has too big an influence over government, it's not a good thing for our democracies. Governments should work for the people. We know this. They shouldn't work for big industry. When they get too close, it means we often get these kind of closed door decision making where companies are calling the shots on government policy, and it's really, really harmful to our democratic processes. And this isn't just happening in these kind of far right governments. Here in Australia, for example, we just saw a case where there was quite massive industry influence over what has been known here in Australia as our nature positive laws, which is this big kind of overarching environmental legislation in Australia. What it appeared as though was happening was quite recently the West Australian Premier, who is a Labor Premier, not a far right Premier by any means, but the Premier, it appeared as though, was effectively lobbying the federal government here in Australia on behalf of the West Australian fossil fuel industry as a way of kind of getting in the way of those laws being passed and stopping those laws from actually getting passed. I mean, this shouldn't be happening. Our governments shouldn't be acting on behalf of big businesses, particularly, when we know through polling that more and more people want to see action on climate change.
Yeah, well, it's those deep pockets you talked about, isn't it? I guess that even relatively right-thinking governments can be seduced by big enough offers of, you let us do this and we will put some money towards this other thing. Okay, I wanted to come on to something a little bit different, which is something we talk a little bit about in terms of our tactics, which is about the pros and cons of targeting individuals. So obviously fossil fuel corporations are huge. They have massive amounts of money, and they feel like you can't get your hands around them. But at the end of the day, even fossil fuel corporations are collections of human beings. And I wanted to know how you feel about whether they're fair game.
I guess there are kind of probably two parts to my answer on this. And I guess the first part is I don't know it's possible to provide a clear cut or kind of generalized answer on this. I think it's always going to be on a kind of case by case, action by action basis. So I think there might be important questions that we might ask when trying to kind of decide whether a particular action is, justified or right, which might be, whether there's kind of a sound internal action logic before the action. Is the action, pushing the campaign goals forward? Actions should tell a story. And so is that story kind of compelling and irresistible? What kind of story is that action telling? I think these are really important. And I think the answers to those questions are always going to vary action by action. So I don't think there's a kind of one size fits all answer to the question. But I guess the second part of my answer is that when we're jumping out to critique particular actions or to question their validity, I think it's really important that we consider kind of power dynamics first, right? Who has power in these situations? And there's a really clear example of this here, of an action like this here in Western Australia, where I'm based, where a group of activists targeted Meg O'Neill, who's the CEO of Woodside Energy, and they targeted her house, her private residence. Now, the government, the media, the West Australian newspaper here, they were really, really quick to condemn that action as going too far and to treat Meg O'Neill as this victim, But I think, when you then look at the kind of retaliation that the activists faced from kind of what were essentially kind of restraining orders placed against them, what were essentially kind of counter-terrorism raids perpetrated against them by the police. One of the activists literally had a gun pulled on him by a plainclothes police officer.
Oh
I
my
think it's,
goodness.
it's pretty clear who has the power in these kinds of situations, right? The power of the state, the power of police, the power of the media. And I guess, like if activism is about using the kind of small resources that we have to stand up against what can often be these really powerful oppositions, I think it's important that we don't allow ourselves to be kind of swept up in a narrative that peaceful activists are the aggressors in these situations, and that these fossil fuel executives are the victims, because I don't think that's often the case, you know. So I guess my answer to that question, broken down, is yeah, I guess questioning, you know, is the action logic sound? Is there a compelling narrative to the action? But then also thinking about the power relations, and the answers to those questions are going to vary action by action for sure.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that, and it's certainly a high risk strategy in terms of backlash and many other things, and individual risk. You talk in the report about a lot of things that fossil fuel companies are doing, and I wonder if you can also put your feet in their shoes and think, what are some of the new things that we should be on the lookout for? For example, like there's a lot of talk about carbon credits these days, with sometimes mind-boggling levels of nonsense, and I wonder whether there's other things that you think we should be alert to that they might be trying in the coming years.
I think the tactics that we've kind of listed in our article that these fossil fuel companies are using to obstruct climate action, I think they offer this really kind of useful blueprint to start with. But obviously, as we know, these companies, they're always getting more creative, more clever in how they go about obstructing action. And even just within these own tactics, like I talked about before with these slap suits, they'll find new ways of targeting more people through these tactics that they've been using for a while. I guess, you know, things to be wary of. I'm always wary of these kind of blue sky tech solutions that are put forward by these companies. As we know, that the tactic always used to be to just deny that the climate crisis was happening, and now it's obviously to try and more kind of create this appearance of action, where kind of this action in the present is, you know, being more and more sacrificed for greater and greater levels of accounting and more data and more research, and we need more investment in tech and you know, these fancy tech solutions. And I think things like this can be a really big get out of jail free card for governments and for companies, right? Because they get to appear as these concerned climate citizens while avoiding any actual action. So I think we always need to kind of be on the lookout for new instances of those kinds of things. Definitely, yeah.
I mean, it's a really good point about carbon capture and kind of like get out of jail free card, because it's like they're saying, yeah, we know that there is a problem now and finally admitted it, but don't worry because we've got the solution as well.
Yeah, and
Just,
so somehow the solution is you've got to invest more in us and in our technology, right?
yes. But it's also really complicated because the truth of the matter is we need to reduce emissions as fast as we possibly can, and we need to take carbon out of the atmosphere. And so there's levels of, it's not as clearly black and white as they're saying things which are completely untrue. There is a grey area in the middle where there's a lot of debate about actually what are the approaches that we need to reduce global temperatures at the speed with which we need to reduce them. And it might be that there are some of those tech solutions that are part of that mix, which sits uncomfortably with a lot of environmentalists and gets into very murky water in terms of the fossil fuel companies.
I think it's such a good point, and I think it's one of those things where perhaps some of those skills around, you know, combating misinformation that we talked about before come into play, right? Because it's absolutely true that a lot of these solutions are important, and we need to invest more in research. But when we're looking at kind of what's working and what's not, and what's, you know, worth being invested in and what's not, often it's important for us to question, okay, well, who's sharing this, and who's asking for investment, and why, and what are their motivations, so that we can make sure that we're putting our efforts, you know, where they are actually best needed, and not just propping up this kind of dying industry.
Yes, let's get that phrase dying industry out there a bit more. Okay, so just a couple more questions for me. So, one which is again a slightly future thinking one. So, is there anything that we can use from what we've learned about the tactics that fossil fuel companies use to be better prepared in other areas? So at the moment, I'm kind of thinking quite a lot about AI, and obviously you have a situation there where there's a huge concentration of power within a few big corporations who are doing things which are potentially very beneficial and potentially extremely harmful. And are there any peremptory tactics that we should be thinking about for problems that might be coming down the line in other areas?
Yeah, no, it's such a great question, and I do think AI is a really great example there, and I guess, you know, maybe one of the lessons is perhaps not letting ourselves be distracted by the narratives that these industries are putting out. You know, it's that tactic that these companies are using of kind of framing and reframing the debate. And so, you know, for the fossil fuel industry, you know, that often looks like, you know, techno-optimism and shifting blame onto individuals and carbon footprints and, you know, all of these things that allow the companies to portray themselves like these kind of responsible climate citizens while kind of shifting that blame and that focus and that need for action. But I think we see some of those same tactics used in the tech industry as well. You know, there was the case, I think, a few years ago where a whole bunch of, you know, companies and individuals were signing on to an open letter calling for this pause in training AI, and they were warning that there were going to be these kind of massively dystopian risks in the future if we don't kind of pause AI development. And that can all sound really good, right? Like, oh yeah, look, they're on side. But it kind of lets these companies and these individuals cast themselves as the heroes. You know, I think one of the signatories was Elon Musk, which should be a red flag to begin with. But often, like the kind of sensationalized scenarios of the future that they're spreading about AI can end up distracting from the really real harms that are being done right now. You know, the racist and sexist biases that we know these machines are being trained on right now, and the harms that they're doing to communities right now. And so I guess, again, you know, letting these kind of industries and these industry insiders frame the narrative stops us from seeing what's kind of right in front of us. So we always need to be really wary about those kinds of narratives and solutions that are being put forward by the industry and by industry insiders. I guess, you know, more generally, you know, absolutely yes, the tactics that we've outlined in this article are visible in other industries. And actually the tactics were based on some research by the work of academics Lacey Nichols and colleagues, which was actually looking at public health. And so when we think, you know, for example, about tactics used by tobacco companies to avoid responsibility for health harms, we're seeing, you know, we saw really, really similar things to what the fossil fuel industry does today. So yeah, I think these tactics we can look at and we can apply to a whole host of different industries that might be causing harm for sure.
Yes, it's depressing, isn't it, that we hear the term the playbook, like the tobacco industry playbook is now being, you know, like other people singing from those hymn sheets. And we need to work on our own playbooks. And so my last question on that note is, where should we look for hope in terms either of countries or organizations or particular approaches? Where do you find hope?
Look, I guess just generally, I think we should look for hope in each other, even when our approaches and our tactics and our strategies differ. I think, you know, if fossil fuel companies are using such varied tactics to obstruct climate action, as we've seen through this, you know, playbook, then, you know, the strength of the climate movement is the diversity within it, is the diversity of tactics and strategies and theories of change that exist in it. And so the fact that we have so many different groups and so many different individuals pushing for change in so many different ways, I think is really powerful and is our best way of, you know, hitting this opposition from as many sides as possible. And so yeah, I think that gives me hope for sure.
Hear, hear. Totally, totally agree with that. Thank you. And yeah, very much recommend that everyone reads the full report because it's a slightly eye-watering account of tactics, but really thorough and fascinating.
No, fantastic. Thank you. And yeah, I've really enjoyed digging into it with your amazing questions. And I think, yeah, your final question there brings us beautifully into your report, which looked at strategies and tactics that we can use and that have been used to curb the fossil fuel industry. And so, yeah, I'd love to, I guess, turn our attention to that report now and maybe ask you a few questions about the report and about your findings. To kick it off, I'm really interested, what are the, I guess, top lessons that you'd like activists to take away from your report when they're going about their business of planning campaigns, around the fossil fuel industry?
So I think Probably the number one thing I'd say is there are a lot of different approaches that you can take. So when we started this work, we kind of were thinking, oh, we'll outline kind of, I don't know, half a dozen different approaches and go into them in a certain amount of detail. But as we looked into it, the sheer number of different ways that you can get at the fossil fuel industry was really a kind of a good surprise in some way. So I think in terms of the report, I think in the end there were like 16 or 17 different tactic sheets, as we called them, where we talk about different approaches, what their theory of change is. We give examples of where they've been used in the past, different organizations who are using them now. So I think the number one sort of like take-home message is there are so many approaches that it's important to do what feels right for you, for your strengths and capabilities. So if you're a complete data nerd, then maybe picking the financial intermingling of insurance companies and fossil fuel companies and exposing it might be something that you could really work on. If you're more a kind of creative designer thinking person, then you can design a brilliant banner which shows the hypocrisy of allowing fossil fuels to support cultural institutions, arts institutions and theatres and so on. And if you're really someone that has great courage and is out for a fight, then maybe you want to go for a kind of public shaming tactic where you do target individuals at, in very high profile positions at relevant events. Like, I think it was interesting what you were saying about the backlash when activists targeted someone at home. I think that there are people who successfully target individuals, but I think the most successful actions tend to be when they're going about their fossil fueling, and there's a clear justification for that targeting. So I think that, yeah, that's really important to bear in mind is there's an approach for everybody. And I think often when people think about activism, it can feel slightly alienating because people imagine this very confrontational stance where you're literally face to face with your adversary. And actually, a lot of activism isn't like that and doesn't have to be like that. And there is a place for everybody. So I think that, plus the final point you made about acknowledging that you're working as part of a very complex ecosystem and recognizing that even if you don't necessarily agree with other people's strategies and tactics, there are ways to make the whole more than the sum of the part. And I think knowing that other people are pursuing different but aligned approaches is also can help sustain your resilience and your tenacity to keep going in the long term, because that's probably what's going to be needed. And also, I would just say doing anything is better than doing nothing. Even if you're doing something, is having a conversation with that neighbor who you think is maybe, has got some ideas that are maybe being taken down a particular track, maybe by disinformation or something, is just have that conversation, have that human connection with somebody and talk about these issues.
Yeah, fantastic. No, I think that's such a good point, and I think it's one of the reasons why it's been so wonderful to kind of compare, I suppose, our two different pieces of research, because when you look at our article and how diverse, all of the things that the fossil fuel industry is doing and the tactics that they're using, it's so absolutely true that the only way to fight back against that is by having that same diversity in our movement. And I guess that kind of takes me into my next question, which is, we've seen, through polling, through all these different things, that there is this really broad public support for climate action, and yet we're still not seeing enough action, by governments and by decision makers. And so I guess, my question is, if public opinion isn't convincing decision makers to take action, what kind of tactics did you find to be more effective? Were there specific tactics that were particularly effective at stalling or disrupting fossil fuel projects?
Well, firstly, I just want to go back to the first part of the question there, because I think it's such an an important point, and I don't think it's said enough, that the majority of the public in everywhere in the world wants to see a cleaner, more sustainable world that is at manageable temperatures. Like the support for greater action on climate is very, very high. So that's really important in itself. But what's an even more important point, I think, is there's a great piece of data analysis by Our World in Data, which not only shows that fact that there's very high levels of public support for more action, but also that people consistently underestimate what other people believe about this. In other words, people think we care about this, we care about climate, but other people don't care as much. And I really want to make the point that people are wrong about that. The truth is that we care about climate and other people also care. And I think for me, that's one of the greatest sources of hope is there's this huge untapped majority who support a rapid transition from fossil fuels. And so that's one reason why talking about it and letting everyone know that they're not in a minority who want that, they're actually in a majority. It could not be more important, and I think is the single probably most potent pushback to the fossil fuel industry, because who can fight a majority of people? So I think even more than saying this tactic is particularly effective, we didn't really evaluate like the relative effectiveness, because I think there's so many things that make that very, very difficult to do, because context is so different, and different countries and different times will all affect outcomes. But I think that the idea that pursuing many, many, many different approaches in concert, bringing behind you this feeling that actually the majority are gonna back you, even if it's not sort of vocally out on the streets, but the majority are there backing these changes, then yeah, that's the power that we have.
Fantastic. No, that's such a good point. And I think it comes back to one of those tactics that we were talking about previously, the astroturfing tactic that fossil fuel companies are using that is really feeding that fear, right, that people have that, oh, I care about climate change, but there's all these people out there who are against climate change action and who are pro coal and these things, and fossil fuel companies are kind of feeding that narrative by creating these fake groups and these fake community kind of sentiment. When, as you say, the reality is actually the vast majority of people want climate action, want a cleaner world, and that it's just simply not true that, we have big sections of our community that are trying to stop climate action. So yeah, no, I think that's such an important point that you're making there.
Yeah, and it's that's a really good link to the astroturfing, because fossil fuel companies wouldn't have invented astroturfing were there genuinely grassroots organizations who in large numbers were supporting, new coal plants being built or a new fracking campaign. So the fact that they're having to invent astroturfing is in itself a statement of their knowledge that actually the majority of people are against them. So in a way, even though it's really cynical and kind of disgraceful, it's in a slightly obtuse way, it's kind of a source of hope, the fact that that has to be invented, right? We'd be much more worried if it was real.
Yeah, absolutely. And meanwhile, as we know, as climate activists, the community building and the community organizing that goes on the ground is very real in our movement and is full of, amazing people on the ground who are trying to make a difference. So it's so important that we actually compare that. Yeah, and I guess, yeah, we often think about, trying to use our campaigns to change public awareness and to increase public awareness about climate action. But as you say, maybe the more important thing is to demonstrate just how wide, public awareness and public support for climate action already is. One of the tactics that you did kind of talk about in your report, though, that I'm really interested in was targeting fossil fuel financing and insurance and things like that. You really drew that out in your report as being quite an effective strategy. And I'm interested, what What was it about that strategy that kind of gave evidence that it was having an effect where it was being used?
Well, I think with insurance companies in particular, I think that there is just such a clear logic behind targeting them. There's a few reasons for that. So I think one is insurance companies kind of position themselves as society's risk managers. And so they have massive reputational risk. Like they're kind of customer facing. Unlike a lot of like fossil fuel dealings, insurance companies are consumer facing because most of their money comes from insuring our homes and insuring our cars and insuring health and those kind of things, like more day-to-day things. And to do that effectively, they need public trust. And how can they have public trust when they are, on the one hand, refusing insurance to people in California for fire, and at the same time, insuring fossil fuel projects which increase the risk of fire? Like that contradiction, I think, is something that can be really, really highlighted. The contradiction and the hypocrisy of that can be really, really called out. So that's one really important thing, is kind of like the risk, their reputational risk. I think that they also, that they're massively financially exposed to climate disasters. So if you look at the data on this, it's a shocking increase that you'll see over kind of the last couple of decades. Between, like, in the first 20 years of the 21st century, a third of all insured losses were attributable to climate change, hundreds of billions of dollars. And that share is rising every year. Every year that we have record heat again, and we have record fires, and we have record floods, and we have record typhoons is going up. So they're massively financially exposed. But, and this is the thing that really surprised me, a fairly small part of their revenue share comes from fossil fuel underwriting. So if you look at insurance companies as a whole, then insuring fossil energy is a tiny part of their business. It's like usually less than 2%. So it's not as if they have to keep insuring these projects because they really need the income from these projects. It actually wouldn't harm them that much to say no to financing projects of fossil fuels. So there's kind of like this whole combination of financial reasons, hypocrisy reasons, their own financial exposure. Like they can see, looking ahead, looking to 2050 or even 2030, that insurance companies are not going to be able to exist anymore because they're not going to be able to support the level of losses which are going to be coming. And even like there's an amazing, I mean, slightly mind-blowing, I think it's a LinkedIn article, but if you Google Gunther Thallinger, who's the chief exec of Allianz, who's one of the big insurers, he's talking about the end of capitalism, and he's talking about the need to, like, the urgent need that we reach net zero by 2050, I think he's talking about. And he says this is not about saving the planet. This is about saving the conditions under which markets, finance, and civilization itself can continue to operate. So, in other words, even if you don't care about like the earth burning and millions of people losing their livelihoods and even their lives, then please care because you should care about capitalism being able to continue. So I think there's a whole complete logical story for why targeting insurers makes a lot of sense. And to some extent, I think they know this. So there's a very impressive organization called Insure Our Future, who do, like when I mentioned, if you're a data nerd, then there is absolutely a place for you in the climate movement, because what they do is a lot of number crunching and looking at picking apart all of the who's underwriting this project, but who's also kind of like gaining from this project. And they have a scorecard where they rank all of the different insurance companies according to decisions that they've made about stopping underwriting. Like there's been real wins in terms of insurance companies stopping underwriting coal projects, because coal projects, like, let's use that nice phrase about the dying industry. Coal is clearly a dying industry. Here in the UK, it is a dead industry. And making oil and gas go that same way as quickly as possible is part of what they're about. And the way that they do it is by having a lot of very sort of like open information about the sort of what's going on under the hood. method of the financing of these projects and the sort of like intermingling of insurance companies and big finance and fossil fuels. It's a really good place to target. To give an example for the insurance case, which is actually relevant to where you are in Australia, because I think that there was a lot of work around the Stop Adani Coal Mine in Queensland. That was, I mean, it wasn't 100% win, but I think there was a massive coalition there of environmental campaigners, indigenous groups who obviously own the land, marine protection organizations who were concerned about the coal mine's effect on the Great Barrier Reef. And there was a really effective coalition of campaigners who basically, through their work over many years, led to over 40 insurers pulling out of underwriting that project. And I think that what was really promising there was the kind of knock-on effects of one insurance company saying, actually, no, this is a bit toxic for us, makes it that much harder for the next insurance company to say, oh, well, we're fine with it. You know, so there was this sort of virtuous effect of insurance companies all saying, actually, no, we don't want our name to be associated with this. And so even though it wasn't stopped outright, it was massively scaled down. So even though that's still really bad, it's a massive, massive win. And I think that that's maybe a point that we haven't really made yet, but that I think is important, because I think the motivation to continue with activism and campaigning and the resilience you need makes it very important that you do acknowledge and celebrate even partial victories as a way of kind of helping sustain your morale. And I often, like, I mean, as a slightly sideways example, I often talk about this with my kids. So I don't eat meat, and they sort of want to not eat meat, but they do really like eating meat. And I say to them that if they eat half as much meat, then that's really, really a great thing. And if they can manage to get to, you know, like one meal a week is meat instead of 7 meals a week is meat, then that's a really, really big win. Like, we don't have to be completely purist in order to celebrate success.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I think we need to get so much better in the movement at celebrating successes, because there are so many of them, and it's so easy to want to, you know, run straight into the next thing because the problem we're facing is so giant. But yeah, it's so important for our own morale, and also to demonstrate our power as well, to celebrate those successes along the way.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, it's so important that we do think kind of strategically about, you know, in particularly in these situations where there's really high levels of state capture and of, you know, this revolving door between fossil fuel industry and governments. You know, what are those pressure points that we can target to have the biggest difference? And yeah, I think that those points that you make in the report around insurance industry are just so important and so fascinating. Yeah, so one interesting example from your report was the rights of nature legal approach. And I'm not sure that it's one that everyone's going to have heard about. So I was wondering if you could tell us more about that, and particularly, are there any instances where it's been effective and where activists have been able to use it effectively?
Yeah, and I think the point here is that just as fossil fuel companies can come up with new ideas, so can their adversaries. And what the Rights of Nature movement does is it grants legal status to natural entities, so rivers or forests or ecosystems. And what that means is that fossil fuel companies can then be taken to court for harming those entities. Yeah, I think one of the most convincing examples is the Whanganui River in New Zealand, which in 2017 was given basically legal status, with which meant it had the rights, duties, and liabilities of a legal person. And I think it worked there because there's kind of a clear governance structure for the river. There's a sort of model based on Indigenous law. I think that that came about because of Indigenous advocacy over many, many decades. And then there've been, I think, as soon as I think that had a real influence on other nations. So very shortly after the Wanganui was given its own legal identity. The courts in India declared that the Ganges River had the same legal rights, and Bangladesh gave all its rivers legal rights. So I think that in itself, maybe that doesn't do something very tangible, but it does give potential for future litigation, which involves harms to those entities.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, as you say, it's such a fantastic example of the climate movement getting creative with its tactics and then having that kind of spread throughout different parts of the world. And yeah, as we've said, it's a diversity of approaches that are going to get us to our goals. So we talked a little bit about fossil fuel, you know, misinformation and disinformation earlier. I'm wondering as well, are there any specific tactics that you found that have helped activists to push back against fossil fuel misinformation and disinformation?
Yeah, I mean, I think you gave some very interesting sort of tips on this. And I would add to that one thing that we haven't really talked about yet, which is kind of wit. And I think that that's actually a different way of pushing back against these things, is sometimes with really good sticky phrases like big oil new, which was used by a lot of campaigners, I think really works, because people know that big oil knew, like people know about that, what the tobacco industry did, and people know about this playbook. And so I think sometimes a simple phrase which is really sticky can be the most effective. Like, don't get into the weeds of, like, you know, what is and isn't thing. Like, by all means, use the truth sandwich whenever you have the chance. But I think sometimes just like operating on a slightly different level and doing creative stunts, led by Donkeys, are an organization, UK-based organization, who just do fantastically witty, pithy, slogan-based advertising campaigns that gets in front of loads and loads of people, which call out all kinds of hypocrisy. And I think those sorts of approaches can be really powerful.
Yeah, I think keeping things simple when we're talking about misinformation, disinformation is really important, right? Because so often misinformation and disinformation kind of thrives on confusion and making things overly complicated. But really, yeah, keeping our messages simple can be such a great antidote to that.
And actually, yeah, just seeing someone dressed up as a massive droplet of oil can actually cut through a lot of that sort of thing. So yeah.
We've already talked quite a lot about how, you know, a diversity of approaches is really important, and a mix of tactics is really important, and that kind of ability to collaborate across difference is an important strength of the movement. And so I guess, you know, thinking about that, are there any approaches or tactics that you think are perhaps not working so well, perhaps, that the movement should leave behind, even though we do acknowledge that it's the diversity that is important?
I think in a way, my answer to this is, just as there's no magical thing that always works, I don't think that there's a dastardly thing that never works. And I think that there's obviously been a lot of attention in recent years on disruptive protest and civil disobedience and very eye-catching actions like throwing soup on Van Gogh paintings. And it's the kind of thing that there's people love to have an opinion about. And I think that what I would say about those sort of tactics is that movements really are ecosystems, and how we think about different actions and their effectiveness really does depend on what the particular goal is. Like, if your goal is to really just raise the salience of an issue very, very quickly, then a dramatic act of disruption is the most effective, or one of the most effective ways to do it. And that has a role in certain places and times, like maybe when people's attention is elsewhere and needs to be brought back to some important thing. But then there'll be other times when, maybe if we're further along with a discussion, when there's obviously a risk that comes with those sorts of things, in that those sort of actions can really get people's backs up, and you risk backlash, you risk kind of polarizing opinion about them. And so that balance of, do you want the attention at the potential risk of downside is a different equation depending on where you are in your campaign. It might be that if you're further along and you're actually kind of like making some headway, then that backlash is, the cost of that is too great. But if you're early on and you just think, this item's not on the agenda at all, I need to get it on the agenda, then that's when that might be the right time for that approach. Like I said right at the beginning, I think that doing anything is better than doing nothing. I don't think there's anything that we should just say, don't do that. But I think that there are ebbs and flows in different tactics over time, and the adversary keeps shifting. And so activists have to keep shifting, and things are changing, and things that were once fashionable become unfashionable. And I mean, I suppose what we try and do at Social Change Lab, which I haven't really mentioned so far, is we try and understand some of the dynamics within that ecosystem. So, for example, if you do have a radical group who are acting as part of a movement, what is the effect of their campaign on the movement as a whole? And sometimes that can be positive. It can be like, well, we've really raised this issue and we've made the job of other people in the movement easier as a result of that. And I think that's something we really saw with Insulate Britain, for example, where they really raised the salience of the issue of home insulation. And it can sometimes be negative. Like you can have a negative radical flank effect where actually the actions of people doing civil disobedience or things that people might take issue with can negatively affect the rest of the movement because, people tarnish everyone with that same brush. So I think there's a lot of complex dynamic that are at play here, and it's never as simple as just, tactic A is good or tactic B is not good.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think it's such an important point, and it's the point that it is so contextual, right? Different actions are going to work better in some areas and not so well in others, and in some contexts and not in others. And thinking about that strategy piece is so important in our work. I guess I just one final question. And it's very similar to your final question for me, but as we've seen, climate activists are often up against this really powerful and innovative of opposition. Were there any examples from your research that did give you kind of real hope about the ability for the climate activists to push back against this powerful fossil fuel industry?
I think there were many examples, and I think partly hope came from just realizing how many people there are who are fighting in so many different creative and committed ways on this is in itself is a source of hope. In terms of specifics, I think that the Adani coal mine example, which I gave, I think is a, whilst not 100% success, I think was a really important improvement on what would have been. I think that groups like Climate Defiance, who kind of burst on the scene in the US last year with a very kind of confrontational approach of publicly shaming individuals who are very highly, sort of strongly implicated in fossil fuel companies, I think they really saw some tangible wins of, they were invited to the White House for discussions as a result of their campaigns. That's an extraordinary result. I think shifts happening in the insurance industry are a source of hope. I think that the thing that I personally find most heartening is when you see coalitions really win. And I think in the report, we talk a little bit about the anti-fracking campaign in the UK and how that was just a really successful example of activists with different backgrounds and, different sort of micro hopes managing to unite around a very clear adversary and having a common goal, and where you saw big NGOs really supporting some of the smaller grassroots groups, not in a kind of virtue signaling way, but in a way where they were giving a lot of back office support, they were giving a lot of money, and then allowing the win to be celebrated as the win of the grassroots organizers. I've talked a bit about that, the sort of resilience that you need to keep going. And I think coalitions are just so helpful and powerful for that. And then behind all of that point I feel like we can't say enough, which is if you think we need more action on climate, you are in the majority.
Yeah, absolutely. Gosh, what a great point to end on. Thank you so much, Kathy, for joining me today for this conversation. It's just been so wonderful to hear about the work you're doing at Social Change Lab and to hear about this amazing report. I really encourage everyone to go and have a read. It's called Strategies and Tactics to Curb the Fossil Fuel Industry, and it's out on the Social Change Lab's website.
And likewise, like, thank you for all the work you do at the library. It's just such an amazing resource for campaigners and activists.
Thanks, Kathy.